The Guardian.
This is Politics Weekly. I'm Heather Stewart.
We had a discussion and the meeting was useful, but inconclusive.
It's all eyes on Jeremy Corbyn this week, as the embattled Prime Minister reached out to the Labour leader to find a route through the Brexit impasse. Can Corbyn and May bury the hatchet and reach a cross-party consensus with just days to spare? Signs so far are fair to middling, and if they can't, what on earth happens next? Also this week, we talked to one of the activists who disrobed in Parliament to protest about climate change.
People have been signing petitions and writing to their MPs for years, and it's been totally ignored.
And what toll is Brexit taking on the nation's mental health? That's all in this week's Politics Weekly. But first, after 3 years of turmoil, billions of pounds spent and three failed attempts at getting her deal through Parliament, Theresa May stopped trying to exit the EU with Tory and DUP votes this week and turned instead to Labour. May hopes that Jeremy Corbyn will help her finally engineer a majority in the Commons, but the omens aren't great. The Eurosceptic wing of the Tory party reacted with predictable outrage. A man who sides with terrorists and socialist dictators has now been given the keys to Brexit, Priti Patel tweeted. And if Corbyn can't even share the same room as Chucka Ramunna, then forging an alliance with Theresa May may be a bit of an ask. Well, I'm joined to discuss all this by Zoe Williams and Lisa O'Carroll from The Guardian and Henry Newman from Open Europe. Hello, everyone.
Hello.
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 Henry, what prompted Theresa May's change of heart?
Well, I think she's running out of options at this point, and she's very keen to deliver a negotiated Brexit. I think she takes that sort of moral responsibility and that political responsibility very seriously. She has tried repeatedly to cajole MPs, to beg MPs, to shout at MPs, and that hasn't worked. She's tried to cut deals with the sort of Eurosceptic side of her party, but also the Remain side, and she made quite a significant progress. And I think we saw just before when she tried to introduce just the withdrawal agreement, some of the big dominoes falling. We already had Jacob Rees-Mogg, Boris Johnson and Dominic Raab came across. But I thought what was most interesting is that they weren't able to persuade about two dozen of the Eurosceptic critics to follow them, which perhaps suggested they had less influence and reach over that wing of the party than perhaps we'd thought previously about those figures, those sort of big beasts on the backbenches. But she also couldn't persuade about half a dozen Remain critics on her backbenches to back the deal either. So she's snookered to a degree, and she couldn't persuade the DUP to support her either. And I think she recognises that actually Jeremy Corbyn is somebody who is not completely committed to a second referendum. We'll come on to discussing that a bit further. And may be interested to find some way of allowing a form of Brexit to be delivered on perhaps slightly different terms, but perhaps she's more likely to be able to cut a deal with Jeremy Corbyn than with Labour backbenchers.
And Lisa, right up until the last minute, they still held out hope that the DUP might come on board, didn't they? Even last Friday, they were still saying, we're going to talk to the DUP, we're going to keep talking to them over weekend. And then, you know, by the end of the weekend, they were saying she could bring this deal back 1,000 times and we're not going to vote for it. What's happened there?
Isn't it so interesting? You know, £1 billion confidence and supply agreement has turned to nothing. And I think if anybody had advised Theresa May on the DUP from the get-go, she would have been told there is no point in spending £1 billion on the DUP. They will vote the way they vote and have done for the last 30 years. They are a party that said no to the Belfast Agreement or Good Friday Agreement, as it's called. In 1998, they said no to the Anglo-Irish Agreement that Thatcher and Garrett Fitzgerald signed in 1985. And they said no to Sunningdale in 1973, which was 2 years after Ian Paisley Sr., best known for his no surrender motto, founded the party. So the DUP have been consistent throughout.
And yet somehow Theresa May has constantly felt that she could just get them over the line. There's something she could offer.
It's very interesting, isn't it? Because I don't think any of us were kind of prepared for the intransigence that we're seeing from the DUP or from anybody.
Not just
really.
The DUP, right?
I mean, yeah. It's really, Fintan O'Toole was saying, it's the way to kind of reconciliation is to stop asking, what would I die for? And start asking, what can I live with? And that's the absolute opposite of what everybody's doing. Nobody's asking, what can I live with? And everybody's asking, what would I die for? And so you're getting quite kind of radicalism and that same stubbornness from people who you don't expect it from. But obviously, people who've got a real pedigree in it They just died. They're going to die in a ditch.
And I think they were also really, you could tell from the tone of statements last week, they were really exasperated with the queue of MPs, particularly the ERG, lining up to blame them. Mm. To say, if the DUP switch, we'll switch. You know, they are not the Tory party.
Yeah, I think it's, I think speaking to civil servants who've been involved closely with the negotiations with the DUP, they were quite optimistic that there were moments when the DUP really wanted to support the deal. So I think this was less, this was, I don't buy into this was never going to work narrative. I think there were moments it could have worked. My understanding is that actually the DUP were quite worried by the possibility of a different Tory leader taking over for the second phase of Brexit and ultimately selling out, as they see it, Northern Ireland, going back to a Northern Ireland-only backstop, and that their private conversations with Tory leadership backbench hopefuls, should we say, were quite worrying for them. And that's also contributed to their concerns. But I understand their position to a degree, but I don't really see how they thought Brexit was going to work overall, other than by resulting in some degree of hybridity for Northern Ireland. You can think that the backstop gives too much control to the European Union side of that hybrid arrangement, but what else was this? How else were we going to get through this problem? And what Arlene Foster used to say was that she wanted the best of both worlds, access to Ireland in the 20s and the EU for Northern Ireland in a better way than Britain, and also access to the UK market. And you can make a case that the backstop offers that, but that's obviously a case that they don't want to make right now.
I'm not so sure she was ever really buying into this best of both worlds, because that's the position of the Farmers Union, that's the position of business, that the backstop does deliver that, that they would remain in the single market more or less, and have access to the UK and the Irish markets. At the core of the DUP, the DUP's heart is in Buckingham Palace. It's the union. Anything that threatens the union is something that they will fight for.
So when Nigel Dodds said, you know, I would actually rather have no Brexit than have anything threaten the union, did you take that at completely face value?
Well, it's a remain, isn't it? He would rather remain.
Yeah, exactly.
Because Northern Ireland is fully aligned to the UK, you know, because it's remains.
It's just extraordinary, isn't it? I mean, you know, if they were a remain party, the DUP, then they would have been much better off not signing a confidence and supply agreement with Theresa May.
Yeah,
in the
you can also see their paranoia. And of course, we've got to also remind everybody always that they're only representing about 50% of the voters in Northern Ireland. But I've spoken to unionists in Northern Ireland who don't support the DUP and don't have confidence in the DUP and say the DUP doesn't represent them. But they are so in despair that once again Northern Ireland is being big-footed by Great Britain, that they're left behind, that nobody cares. And they know that once all this is over and whoever's in power, whether it's Boris or whoever, nobody cares about Northern Ireland.
And Zoe's right, isn't she, that it's not just the DUP who've been holdouts. There's been this process. It's taken such a long time, but there's been this process of, sort of hardening of people's views, hadn't there? And so you had these indicative votes. We've had two rounds of them. Parliament didn't manage to find a majority for anything. And that's partly, isn't it, because people aren't willing to settle for what their second preference or their third preference might be. Everybody seemed to be voting only for their sort of ideal outcome, which is not really how the process is meant to work.
But I think that's the nature of Brexit, right? Because actually, if you don't get your own ideal outcome, the second best outcome looks like, to all of us, looks like all the downsides of Brexit and none of the upsides. So, you know, you can say, I'm a Remainer, I'm a hard Remainer, but if you, in theory, my second preference is customs union Brexit. But in reality, a customs union Brexit just looks exactly like membership of the EU without any benefits of membership of the EU.
Right.
Well, it doesn't matter what you think for the second, because I'm just explaining how compromise isn't reachable. That puts me then on the same side as Jacob Rees-Mogg. So you know, that's where the second preference takes you.
It Although takes the you risk is then that you end up with a no deal Brexit, right? Because nobody can alight on something that is not perfect.
That's actually, if you just war game it, if the kind of incentive to compromise is if you don't compromise, there's a gun to your head and something catastrophic happens, then that really can't clear the hurdle of the compromise not really looking like everything you want minus 25%.
But
like everything you don't want for no reason.
Mm. But those positions have hardened up over time, right? I mean, you could have looked at Parliament on the morning
totally
after
true.
The 2017 general election and said, we need a softer deal to get through this Parliament. And at that point, some of the MPs who are now People's Vote or Nothing were advocating EEA membership and Norway-style Brexit.
I think you could make a very strong case that if the campaigners for a so-called People's Vote had got their act together straight after the referendum, they could easily have pushed us towards a position like Norway, maybe on an interim basis or maybe even on a potentially semi-permanent basis. But they didn't. And I think what we've seen over the last 2.5 years is not the facts becoming clearer. It's that people have become ever more entrenched in their own positions and ever more divided.
Listen, I want to ask about Jeremy Corbyn and what he should do and how he should play these talks.
Yes.
Zoe, was it the right thing to go into Downing Street and have this conversation? The talks are going on today,
I don't see how he could not have gone in. But look, the only thing he can do at this stage is go in and ask and say that any deal has to be attached to a people's vote. That's the only thing he can do.
But is there a majority in Parliament for that?
Well, if you look at the way the votes came down in the indicative votes, the largest number of votes was for customs union. The lowest number of opposition votes was for Kyle Wilson, which is the ratification referendum. So all the expectation last week was those customs union people would get together with the PV people and they'd get customs union Brexit with a PV attached.
Except a lot of the people who want a customs union want it because they hate the idea of a referendum and therefore they want a deal.
Well, actually, that's what kind of derailed it was that actually there was a lot of jiggery pokery and a lot of people said they were going to compromise and they actually didn't when it came to the vote. So that magical solution, but PV was only 7 votes shy last time it was voted on.
So I think the problem is if your suggestion is that we should put to the people an option of leaving with a customs union or remaining.
No, it would have to be a three-way ballot.
Okay, but I don't...
Between
leaving with a customs union, remaining and no deal.
I don't think that's what people are proposing. And I think...
That's what's going on in Labour PV.
Why wouldn't you just put the deal and then no deal and then? Because I mean, I think
because Labour got themselves in a stupid knot where they had this kind of fantasy Labour Brexit, which is just daft in my view. But that's where they got to. But you know,
the manifesto policy for the 2017 general election.
I mean, look at the did the Conservative manifesto say we're not going to govern for 2 years? We're just going to fight amongst ourselves. Of course they didn't. I mean, manifestos are all up in the air.
Henry, do you think there's anything that can go through Parliament in time? Either for that summit next Wednesday when Theresa May has to say what length of extension she wants, or for May the 22nd.
Yeah, I think if I was trying to help broker a compromise, I would be putting into the political declaration an explicit menu of options. So you put into it Labour's Brexit, you put into it Conservative vision of Brexit, Malthouse, whatever you want, as a future relationship, and you put in, say, Common Market 2.0. And you say to everyone, now your options are explicitly here, in brackets, the EU have already said all those options are possible, close brackets, by negotiation. But anyway, you put those all in explicitly, and you say, either you want a deal, in which case you vote for this, or you want a people's vote, second referendum, in which case, fair enough, that's your choice. But either we have Brexit or we don't. Let's make a decision and let's move on.
So hang on a sec. You would put those three options to Parliament with a PV option also to Parliament. These are options you'd put to actual people.
Sorry, no. I would say to MPs...
They are actual people in Parliament, sorry.
I don't know if they are.
I would put into the political declaration with the EU three options. So if we get through the withdrawal agreement and we leave, you have all those three options are explicitly possible. Parliament sorts that out in the future. And I agree, once the other side of Article 50, if we do get out, then we'll be still having discussions. But there'll be one crucial difference. We won't be discussing whether we leave or not, and we won't be discussing whether we have a second ref or not. And I think we'll then have to focus a bit more on actually the choices once we've left.
Seems to me the one thing that might get Labour over the line is to chuck in a general election. Put all those options in and say, let's have a general election, and that will determine the way forward.
Government should commit, as part of the withdrawal bill, to say that there will have to be a general election before we ratify the future treaty. Now, that's a statement of probable fact anyway, and it allows you to know that if you're the Labour Party, you can go into a general election promising a soft Brexit, and the Tory Party can go into a general election promising a harder Brexit. I think that's a sensible compromise.
If Labour goes into the general election promising any Brexit, they will hemorrhage votes. It was really catastrophic for Labour if they don't actually give their members and their voters some Remain option at some point quite soon. And this whole thing in Cabinet at the moment, John Trickett and in Labour...
Shadow Cabinet, not in power yet.
Sorry. I always forget about the Tories, just my own mental health. The whole thing in Shadow Cabinet about, you know, this is a class divide, all the Northern MPs want Brexit and all the Southern Ponzi MPs want Remain. It's complete fabrication. It's complete nonsense. The idea that working class people in Lambeth are not properly working class, whereas working class people in Wigan are, is just boiling my blood at the moment. It's not a party of Brexit. It's not even a party of soft Brexit. It's a Remain party.
Lisa, what do you think? Chuck in a general election and we'll sort it all.
Well, I was in Ian Lavery's neck of the woods yesterday up in Newcastle, and I did some Vox Pops. And what was really interesting is, you know, you get the predictable, the leavers who say, just get on with it. But there is exasperation, young and old, with what's going on. Mm. And to come back to an earlier point about communications, I think the argument is lost, long lost, on voters. They are now saying, I had an old guy who was retired many years in his 70s, ex-Royal Navy, a leaver, hardcore, let's just leave. He just says customs union is staying in. He's already made up his mind.
So, you know,
the associations within and out are, they've just got new labels. And I had a 30-year-old who educated in term university, who was also saying, let's get out. Let's give Brexit a chance in 5 years' time. If it hasn't worked out and has a catastrophe, we can have another referendum to go back in. People just want it out.
I'm with Lisa. I stood for Parliament in North Tyneside, which is not a particularly conservative part of the world. But I spent a lot of time knocking on doors and talking to people. And I can't believe that. I'm sure people are frustrated by the process now. This is now nearly 2 years on, obviously, since the 2017 general. But at the time, they were perfectly capable of articulating a very solid leave case in a very Labour area.
It's great to do Vox Pops and it's really helpful, but there is a reason why data exists, and that's because it's just a bit more thorough. And the truth of it is, leavers are not coming round to Labour. So pandering to them is not going to help him. Meanwhile, Labour voters overwhelmingly remain. And those Labour voters who did vote Leave, the salience of Brexit has slipped right down. So they're placing it fifth or sixth
but
in their Labour preference. It really doesn't matter whether there are some people in their constituency who are still Leave. What really matters is the people who are Remain, and there's a lot of people who are Remain, do deserve some representation from one political party. And just to be told,
there's one,
ceaselessly.
Change UK.
It's well, two, yeah.
Actually, I mean, it is interesting. I saw a weird figure the other day that only 8% of people identified strongly with a political party, where 40% of people identified strongly with Remain or Leave.
I mean, I agree with what Zoe's saying to a degree, but I also think the strategic problem for Labour is, how do you maintain your current MPs who are broadly Remain, your current activists who are broadly Remain, but you need to win in Leave voting seats, where even in those seats, the majority of Labour voters may be Remain, but to win them, you need to have a message for Leave as well.
Yeah, but look,
otherwise, you have no path to power. And that's the strategic balance that people like Ian Lavery and Jeremy Corbyn himself are trying to grapple with.
No, it's not a strategic balance at all. The truth of it is, if they don't come out for Remain soon, they're going to lose a huge number of Remain votes.
They don't talk about that.
So you get...
How will they lose Remain voters? Because you remember this was a dilemma for Labour supporters in London, for example, over Diane Abbott's performance just before the last election in 2017. And she won landslide victory in her constituency.
You look at places like Canterbury, like Kensington and Chelsea and Westminster, the places that they got unexpectedly out of nowhere in 2017, they will not get again if they don't stick Remain, because those were young people coming in unexpectedly. Scotland, they're going to be absolutely annihilated, and they're banking on 14 seats in Scotland in order to get them over the line. They're not going to get any if they don't go Remain.
They're definitely not going to get those. Well, we could talk about this all day, but we're going to have to leave it there. We'll be back after this.
It's time to focus.
I think ultimately that ideology is fading, but it will have a sting in the tail, and we see that sometimes with these flare-ups and violence.
Today in Focus is the new daily podcast from The Guardian. Join me, Anoushka Astana, for the best stories from our journalists around the world. Subscribe now to Today in Focus from The Guardian.
Welcome back. On Monday, April Fool's Day, a group of climate change protesters were arrested after stripping off in the House of Commons public gallery and gluing themselves to the window. This all happened as Labour's Peter Kyle was speaking in the debate for a second round of indicative votes. When a colleague raised a point of order, Kyle said he was grateful for the cheeky intervention. Protests inside Parliament don't happen very often. The last was 15 years ago when pro-fox hunting protesters succeeded in sneaking into the Commons dressed as construction workers. On the phone now, I have Will Cook from climate change pressure group Extinction Rebellion, who was one of the protesters in Parliament on Monday. Hi, Will. Let's talk about what happened on Monday first. You know, why choose that debate when MPs are talking about Brexit and why take your clothes off? Why is that the right way to get attention?
Well, to be honest, we didn't really choose the Brexit debate. We chose Monday as April the 1st because it was April Fool's Day and because we wanted to promote our action in London, the International Rebellion, on April the 15th. And then somehow the universe provided us with the ideal backdrop for what we were going to do. We were going to do it anyway. And then the Brexit debate, suddenly there was this huge thing happening and the visibility of what we were doing massively increased, which was both terrifying for us, but also like exactly what it was absolutely spot on, basically.
And how much planning do you have to do for something like that? Because there's, you know, very intense security in Parliament, isn't there? It's not easy to, you certainly couldn't have sort of snuck in any kind of, you know, banners or posters or whatever. It's not easy.
Yeah, so the idea first came about probably around Christmas time when one member of our group went into Parliament just from interest. And so the reason for being naked was because we couldn't get banners or anything. And we thought the one thing we can do is paint ourselves up and take ourselves in because, you know, they're not strip searching or anything when you go in. So that kind of happened around Christmas. And then the planning process took probably about 3 months of quite intensive planning. And then we kind of had a meeting a week before the action, where we weren't really intending to come up with a date for it. And then suddenly it was like, oh, Parliament's in recess from the 3rd, so we got to go now. So, yeah, we suddenly kind of threw it together in the last week.
It obviously sort of stopped proceedings, or it didn't quite stop proceedings, but it certainly distracted MPs in Parliament and journalists who were there covering it and so on. Were you pleased with how much coverage it got the next day? Certainly all over all the papers. It was, you know, became memes all over the internet.
Oh, my goodness. Yeah, it's really exceeded our wildest expectations. You know, like we've been all sorts of papers. We've been in the New York Times, Time Magazine now. We've gotten a lot of the papers we wouldn't normally expect to, like The Express and The Telegraph and places like that.
And tell me about, you know, why Extinction Rebellion? Why is it that you feel you have to take this kind of action, you know, rather than signing petitions or writing to your MP or, you know, coming to Parliament in other ways? Why is it you need to take action that results in you being, you know, dragged off by the police? What's motivating it?
Well, I mean, like, people have been signing petitions and writing to their MPs for years. And to be honest, it's been totally ignored. If you look at what's happened with, you know, two of the very biggest marches in recent times, which was the Stop the War protest and the second referendum protest that happened just a couple of weeks ago, they've both been completely ignored, effectively. The largest petition that's gone out recently, again, like a Brexit-based thing, but again, it's being ignored. We've got to take more direct action. We've got to disrupt things because, really, I think it's only, like, politicians talking the language of money in many ways, like their mates are the CEOs of big businesses and so on. So we need to disrupt what people are doing. And this thing on April the 15th is all about disrupting London and disrupting the financial centre so that the government will feel pressure from their mates in big business to come to the negotiating table and meet us.
And just one more thing, Will, if you succeed, for example, on 15th of April and you got the government to come and sit down with you, you got the Environment Secretary Michael Gove around the table, what is it you want the government to do?
So we've got three demands. The first demand is that firstly, the government tells the truth and declares a climate emergency, basically says how bad the problem really is. The second thing we want them to do is to kind of demonstrate that they're making up a target to deal with that. So we want them to commit to going carbon neutral by 2025, which is challenging, but that is the sort of thing that's necessary. And then the third thing we want them to do is to form a citizens' assembly, which is a radical form of inclusive democracy that will help guide our route out of the mess that the politicians have got us into over the last 20 to 30 years.
Thanks ever so much, Will.
Thank you very much.
Now, Lisa, Brexit's just crowded out every other issue, hasn't it?
Absolutely. It's dominating the front pages for probably 99% of the time since November. We've had a figure of 4 billion has been spent on no deal planning. If we get the deal across the line, that's 4 billion wasted that could have been spent on the NHS, on climate change, on environment, whatever. Whitehall has been gridlocked. there are no policies getting through, are there?
Henry, is there thinking going on? When are the Conservatives going to be able to talk about some of these other things?
I think one of the main reasons why things are gridlocked is actually the hung parliament, and that's the single biggest problem facing the government. Brexit is complicated, but that just means there's total gridlock, plus the failures of Downing Street, the PM personally, and so on. But the government is talking about other things, and the news is carrying other things. I think we've seen, actually, the kids' protests around climate change got a great deal of coverage, and that was broadly
but
good.
It's not getting legislative time.
And the government said that they should be at school, for God's sake.
Okay, well, all the legislative time has been spent on statutory instruments to catch up.
I actually think the government's agenda, I would praise my former boss, but Gove has done a huge amount on plastics and environmental questions. This is the one area I think you can say the government has done quite a lot.
That is one area the Food and Drink Federation and 13 or 14 other consortia said they were refusing to engage with Michael Gove on these issues.
Because he's doing too much consultations.
No, because they don't have the capacity to deal with plastic deposit schemes or whatever his politically point scoring schemes are.
Well, I think it's a little unfair.
No. Michael Gove has taken a ministry that was bottom of the pile along with DCMS and made it extremely high profile. He has got things through like getting rid of plastic straws, of et cetera, et cetera.
Sure.
But the industry isn't engaging because they say all
Why
their
is that
time
point scoring?
Because he's creating political capital from these schemes, isn't he? But they're not getting over the line because the industry won't engage with them because all their time is consumed with no deal planning for Brexit.
I will defend Michael. I think when I worked with Michael at Justice, he was given a brief by Cameron to essentially deal with the problems with the judges and basically make Justice quieten down. Michael, after a few months, turned that entire agenda around into prisoner rehabilitation. David Cameron was giving speeches about how prison reform was going to be his legacy in politics.
Yeah, now, but then look at his legacy on prison reform. Well, prisons have never been in a worse state. Suicides have never been higher. Self-harm has never been higher.
I'm not saying there aren't issues in prison.
There's worse issues than there have ever been.
No, but my point is just a political point that Michael has been able to transform different agendas. In DEFRA, again, it's now the case that the Chancellor's most recent spring statement was all about plastics because it's an area where politically Michael's been able to transform the agenda and do things despite the gridlock and Brexit.
But my point is that they haven't actually been done. We don't have a bottle deposit scheme. We still have plastic bags in supermarkets.
Plastic bag usage has dropped precipitously.
No, hang on a sec. Henry, you just made Lisa's point for her. They talk a good game. He talks a good game, but nothing happens and things get worse.
Sorry, that's not
Prisons
true.
Are worse and the environmental provision is worse. And you know it.
Sorry, they're complex problems in prisons, which I agree need to be dealt with, including illegal use of these new psychoactive substances like spice.
Yeah, people
are always
blaming spice, but it's poor staffing.
Both are true. There should be more money spent on prisons. I spent quite a bit of time in prisons. This is really difficult and complex cases, as you know as well.
I do know. Yeah. I mean, I'm on the trust of a prison charity, and I can tell you it's never been worse in 50 years.
I agree, but I think it's a better thing that politicians don't talk about prisons as places which people are sent for punishment, but about rehabilitation. Those are good things.
Yeah, I know, it's great to talk, though, but it's really bad if you don't do it.
Right,
and that is what's going on with Brexit.
Will made the point that you know, you get petitions signed by 6 million people or you get marches and, you know, it's just ignored. Is it right sometimes to break the law, Lisa, do you think, to get a point across when you feel sufficiently strongly about it?
It depends. If
not you personally.
This goes back to my previous career covering the hacking trials and the public interest defence of hacking. If there's a public interest defence, yes. And journalists are often asked, is there justification for breaking the law? Sometimes there is.
But their strategy is partly, as for example the suffragette strategy was, get yourselves arrested because you think this thing is sufficiently... You know,
I suppose there are degrees, aren't there? There's that end of the spectrum right through to terrorism, isn't there? It's a whole different debate, isn't it? But I think the question lots of people are asking is if I signed the petition and 6 million people signed that petition, why isn't Theresa May taking notice of it? Or if there was 1 million people in the streets on last Saturday week, why isn't Theresa May taking notice of it? Which goes back to the point you made, Zoe, which is there has to be somebody to represent those 48%.
OK, thanks all. Now, could Brexit be damaging your mental health? A new poll by the consultancy Britain Thinks has found that 83% of those surveyed were sick of hearing about Brexit, while 64% thought it was damaging their mental health. Zoe, you've written a piece about this today.
Yeah.
You say we're now overwhelmingly a country of pessimists.
It's really, that was the finding that I found most interesting, that Hope Not Hate have been running these mood surveys since 2011. And what they found, which actually really reinforces the Leave case in 2016, was that areas which had classically been pessimistic, like Grimsby and Hartlepool, had flipped quite significantly, 22 points more optimistic after the result. And while areas with Remain voters flipped exactly the same way in the opposite direction. So you had a completely inverted map of optimism and pessimism. And this very much reinforced that case that people made to kind of justify everything that's followed, which is, you know, those areas were left behind. Finally, somebody had listened to them. If you feel as a liberal metropolitan elite that your views aren't being heard and the government, you don't recognise these people in government, that's what people in Grimsby have been feeling for the past 20 years. You know, there was that kind of narrative built up that the left behind areas have finally roared and taken back control. That persisted until 2018. Remainers got more and more pessimistic. Leavers kind of maintained their optimism. And then the most recent poll was, now everybody's pessimistic. It's just everybody in the Leave areas is as pessimistic as they were before, and everybody in Remain areas is as pessimistic as the Leavers used to be.
But there's a serious point. Wasn't there a serious point about people's mental health? And it was the uncertainty. And I think if you're a business, I think a large swathe of the population have turn off the radio. I find myself doing it in the morning. I listen to a bit and then I turn off because I haven't got the capacity. I haven't got the capacity to think about other parts of the world covering Brexit. And I think the survey showed that it's the uncertainty that if you're running a business, you don't know what's going to happen next Saturday.
But it's actually, if you look at that survey, they had a kind of word cloud of the words people use to describe Brexit. And a year ago, it was uncertainty and confusion. And now it's broken and chaos are the words that are coming out.
Henry, so do you think really there was a way of running this process? So I can remember your man, Michael Gove, saying in that press conference in the morning after the result of the referendum, we need to involve different political traditions in negotiating this deal. We need to run this in a way that would be kind of inclusive. Was there a way of doing this that would not have resulted in the entire nation feeling angst-ridden and furious about it?
I think, first of all, you had to work cross-party from the beginning, particularly you had to do that after 2017 when you lost your majority, Theresa May. But from the beginning, I remember in Downing Street, straight after the referendum, arguing that we had to offer a unilateral right for EU nationals who had come here legitimately to straight away just do that to make people feel safe. Yeah. My European friends who felt that they were being used as political pawns, that was horrific. And of course, it contributed to a narrative that the country was divided. She then gave that speech where she talked about citizens of nowhere. Now, you can draw some philosophical lines through that speech, which actually makes sense. But the way it was received by the public was, we hate you metropolitans. You globalised people. We're not on your side. That was crazy. It divided the country rather than bring it together. And this is all about leadership. I think people are in different positions on this. My sister, who's trying to do her medical school exams, rings me up and just says, I can't cope. It's all this Brexit uncertainty. I'm trying to revise what's happening. She's sort of embodying this uncertainty. People say they're sick of listening to it, but they're also obsessed as well. There's this kind of almost gory detail. My boyfriend's family in Italy are WhatsApping him saying, is this an important vote? We're watching the Parliament channel, listening to the speaker as if it's penalty shootouts and it's just some sort of crucial moment. So the whole world is obsessing about it, and that's both a good and a bad thing. But equally, look, yes, this is a mess. Yes, we're 5 minutes to midnight without a lot of clarity, and this is a failure of our political class on both sides of the House and more broadly. But also, I think a lot of the West is experiencing these problems. If you look at the state of politics in America, it's pretty horrific. If you look at the state of politics in France or Italy, even in Germany, this is the Western world is in political flux at the moment. And even Justin Trudeau is embroiled in this enormous scandal. Where is it that the politics are all stable and easy? And I think what's particularly surprising for Europeans is that Britain used to be that anchor of stability and good sense and good order. But the only positive in this is actually, for all the problems, I think Parliament's actually doing its job quite well because it's reflecting the divisions in the country. And that we're seeing more and more focus and attention on the parliamentary process. That's a good thing. We used to have years of huge majorities where everyone would ignore Parliament and voters were offered a political choice between Pepsi and Coke. And now ideas are back in a broader sense. You've got a leftist leader who's on a very different political spectrum from previous leftist leaders. And there is a spectrum there and people want to talk about politics and ideas.
I have to say, you're in a very narrow band thinking that Parliament's doing a good job, because another part of that survey was, not only does they blame basically everybody. These people, 83% of whom just don't want to hear about Brexit ever again, blame every single politician equally. They've got completely scathing about all of them. The only person who gets a mention is David Cameron as the kind of architect of this awfulness. But nobody's looking at Parliament and thinking this is great, they're finally reflecting.
Sorry, yeah, I think Parliament needs to make a decision. I'm not suggesting that this indecision is a good thing, but I think having debates and reflecting those arguments, that's where the country is. The country is really still very, very divided. And we spent 3 years rehearsing the same arguments with more and more feelings each time.
And people are, I have to say, people are politically engaged in a way I have never witnessed.
Exactly.
And coming from a country where you have proportional representation, where you can actually game your ballot, where you go into the ballot box and you might have 10, 15 candidates and you can decide, I'm going to vote for that person because that vote will carry over. You actually have to think, and you think your vote counts. In this country, it doesn't. And I remember coming here in the late 80s first and being astonished that people didn't talk about politics. All they talked about was house prices.
And
I think that's changed. And in a way, isn't that where we are, that the political system itself is broken, that we need to have a conversation about proportional representation in this country.
Totally agree with that. But I agree with you that people are talking politics. You get on the tube and people are discussing Article 50 and talking about different deals. And
my retired man talking about a customs union up in Newcastle yesterday.
I think we should seize on that tiny sort of upbeat note about the increase in political engagement and draw that to a close, I think. Thanks ever so much, everyone.
Thank you.
Well, that's all we have time for this week. My thanks to all our guests, Zoe Williams, Lisa O'Carroll, Henry Newman and Will Cook. The producer was Simon Barnard. I'm Heather Stewart. Thanks for listening.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.